He smiles, his mouth brushing against my temple, his beard tickling my skin. The sight of his injuries makes my stomach clench.
"So I can know you,"
he replies.
"You've met my family, my mother, my grandmother,
Cristina.
I can't help but be curious about yours. I grew up on stories about your grandmother, your great aunts. They were like family to my grandmother."
"My family's complicated." His lips curve.
"Aren't they all?"
"True. Perhaps mine seems a bit more so than most because so many of our foibles have played out in gossip columns. I explain about the rubber heiress, the fact that my grandmother raised me. I've gotten so good at telling the story to people who've asked about my unorthodox family structure throughout the years, why my grandmother sat in the audience at school plays rather than my parents, that I can nearly get through it without a hitch."
"Do you miss your mother? Are you close now?"
Luis asks. I shrug, raising the bottle to my lips once more, the cool drink sliding down my throat. "I suppose I miss the idea of her, what society says the relationship should be, rather than the reality. I never knew her enough to miss her. Even now we're more polite strangers than anything else. I've seen her a handful of times in the last decade, usually when we both happen to be in the same place. We get along just fine.
Still,
I had my sisters, my father, my great-aunts.
Everyone lived close to one another in Florida, so I didn't lack for family. My father was busy with work a lot, but he still made an effort, was around as much as he could be.
Besides, I had my grandmother. That was all I ever needed."
"What was your grandmother like?"
Luis asks, his hand drifting lazily across my hip. Despite the heat, goosebumps rise over my skin. Fierce, unapologetic, proud, loyal, to her country and to her family. I pause. I didn't understand it until now, but there was a sadness in her, a longing. I always thought it was for Gua, but now I wonder if those times when she grew silent, when she was with us and wasn't, if those were the times when she thought of him.
"How is the search going? Have you learned anything else about him since last night? Did my grandmother have anything else to add when you spoke with her this morning?"
"No. I'm hoping Magda will have some answers." He's quiet a moment.
"Your grandmother. You said she was all you had. Is that why it's so important to you to find him?"
I nod. Losing her has been harder than I imagined. I should have realized it would be, but she was always so vibrant, seemed so much younger than her years. And I suppose I took for granted that she would be around a long time. Would see me get married. Hold my child in her arms. A tear trickles down my cheek, and I bat it away. I hate that she's not going to be here for all of these moments. That she won't be here to sing Cielito Lindo to my child like she did to me when I was a little girl. There's this giant hole in my heart. I miss her arms around me. The scent of her perfume, the smell of her cooking. More tears well in my eyes. Another spilling over onto my cheek, then another. Luis's arms tighten around my waist, his lips brushing against my temple. "We had this connection," I continue, the sound muffled against his bare chest. "I could talk to her in a way I couldn't talk to anyone else. Now that she's gone..." I brush at my cheeks and pull back slightly. "I have to find him, to try at least. Right now, their relationship is this giant unknown. It sounds like they loved each other and he was a revolutionary, but beyond that, I have no clue what happened between them. She asked your grandmother to hold the letters for me. She wanted me to come here and spread her ashes, wanted me to find this. My grandmother knew me better than anyone. She knew I'd have to see this through one way or another."
"Are you worried that what you find will change the way you remember her relationship with your grandfather?"
Luis asks, his voice kind. "Maybe. I don't know. I was so young when he died. My perspective of their relationship was a child's perspective. Who knows what goes on behind closed doors?"
"Marriage is hard,"
he agrees. I can't help it. Curiosity has filled me since he first mentioned he was divorced. "What happened between the two of you, with Cristina?" He turns his head to stare out at the water.
"It wasn't one thing," he finally answers, and I realize his silence is more a product of his attempt to answer my question as honestly as possible, rather than discomfort. It would be easier to explain if one of us cheated or we had some big fight, but it wasn't like that at all. Each night we went to bed together, and the next morning we woke up and had drifted a little farther apart than the day before. One morning we woke up strangers. That sounds painful. It was, although I suppose it could have been worse. Our lives simply diverged. She wanted children. When we married, I thought I did too. But the more I thought about it, about the world I was bringing them into, the country I was handing off to them, I couldn't do it. That was my fault. She married me expecting one thing and ended up with another. It wasn't fair to her. I wasn't fair to her. That was my mistake. You learn the deepest truths about yourself when you fail at something. When I failed at marriage, I learned I couldn't pretend to be someone I wasn't in order to please another person. He rubs his jaw, his eyelashes sweeping downward. She thought I was too serious, wanted me to stop holding on to things. He gives a dry little laugh. I'm not the easiest person to live with. His words are both confession and warning. And yet you both still do. Live together. Work in the restaurant together. How do you handle it? How does she? I wouldn't say we live together, exactly. It's not like we share a bedroom anymore. It's different here in Cuba. There's a massive housing shortage in Havana. Cristina wanted to move out, but there was nowhere for her to go, so she's stuck. Thank you, Fidel. I can't even imagine how awkward that must be. The idea of living with one of my exes. You'd think so, but it's not so bad, really. We've become friends more than anything. Family, in a way. Her parents are both dead. She doesn't have anyone else. And I'm fairly certain she's as disinterested in me as anything other than platonic as I am her. Occasionally she'll bring men home, but I make a point to be out those nights. It's not a perfect solution, but you make do. If things don't look the way you anticipated, you change your expectations. It's an easy way to avoid being disappointed. And you never bring women home? Luis grins. I live with my grandmother and mother. What do you think? I laugh. Fair enough. What about you? He takes the drink from my outstretched hand and raises it to his lips. What about me? You never married?
No.
Did you come close?
I've never been engaged or anything like that. My longest relationship was in college. We were together for 3 years.
What happened?
It feels so long ago. In the moment, the breakup had been all-consuming. But now I barely remember why we fell apart. Just life, I guess. We got to the point where we either had to be more serious or go our separate ways. And neither one of us cared enough to take it to the next level.
And since then?
I date, but I haven't met anyone who's made me want more. Until now. What about your family? I ask. Your grandmother mentioned you used to come here with your father. What was he like?
Strict. Luis answers. He was a good father, a good man, but he was a military man, used to giving orders and others following him. He was my hero, though. When he wore his uniform, he was larger than life to me. When I was a very young boy, I wanted to serve in the military like him.
What changed?
I grew up, I suppose. My eyes were open to the reality of life around me. Things were easier when my father was alive. When the regime took care of us because he was a high-ranking official in the military. We still received some financial benefits after his death, but my world changed. My grandparents took us in, and my friends were no longer the children of the privileged, but Cubans who suffered. When the government protects you because you are one of theirs, it's not so bad. But ordinary Cubans inhabit a very different reality.
Still, he's silent.
My father gave his life fighting in Angola, defending its people and protecting them against the United States proxies and their intervention in the conflict. Spent his adult life serving the regime. Sometimes I wonder if he would be disappointed that I haven't done the same, that I'm not honoring his memory.
You've said it yourself.
Your students are the future of this country. It's clear that you love your job, that your students admire you. That's something to be proud of. Your father fought for what he believed in. You do too, even if it doesn't involve picking up a gun. Luis smiles faintly, his lips meeting mine. Thank you. He leans back, staring up at the sky. I lay my head in the curve created between his elbow and his neck, pressing my lips there, inhaling his scent, committing something else about him to memory. For when I'm gone.
Chapter 16. Elisa. The weeks eke by with agonizing slowness after Pablo leaves Havana. December creeping in. The monotony of life punctuated by the occasional bombing, shooting, random attacks that leave our mother even more convinced we mustn't traipse around Havana on our own. I'm fine with the new rules. I'm in purgatory, clinging to each radio report, every scrap of news about the fighting in the Sierra Maestra. Pablo's letters arrive sporadically, delivered by messengers, ferreted to me by the staff members I've recruited through bribery and cajoling. I live in terror of my mother or father finding the letters, of Magda's condemnation, my sister's questions. One afternoon I confide in Anna, telling her I met a man, and little else. I want to talk about Pablo. I want to share this secret with those closest to me. But each time I begin to speak of him, something inside me rebels. Instead, I content myself with the letters he sends me, the ones I write to him. I hide his letters in my room, reading them over and over again when I am alone, when the connection between us is gossamer thin. I worry my own letters won't reach him in the mountains, that they'll be intercepted. Fear I am barreling toward disaster. Despite the way we left things, the uncertainty of us, I cannot stop hoping our relationship isn't finished. When the next letter arrives, I rip it open greedily. There's a stillness in the mountains, a quiet I never found in the city. It's so beautiful. You would love it here. We are drawn to the water, but the countryside has its charms, too. It's so green. We wake up to the sun rising over the mountains, and the view rivals even that over the seawall. The clouds are so low it feels as though you could reach up and touch them. I think of you often. I miss you. I adopt an intense piety I never possessed before, kneeling in the pews of the cathedral and praying God will protect Pablo, keep him safe, bring him back to me. And I worry about Alejandro. Constantly. I'm not sure where God weighs in on the issue of Cuba's future. I fear he created this paradise on earth and left us to fend for ourselves. But I hope he'll protect my brother and Pablo. Hope is all you have to cling to when the world around you evokes every other emotion. I've taken to spending more and more of my days with Anna. We lounge by the pool, drinks in hand, while Maria plays in the water, splashing around. It's hard to reconcile this image of Havana with the one that greets me each time I read my father's discarded newspapers. The news often tells a gruesome tale. Bloody pictures of dead Cubans cover the pages. I can't help it. I search the images, the faces, fearing the day Pablo or Alejandro will stare back at me. Batista has been especially prolific lately, purging the streets of anyone he deems a threat. It must be exhausting to have so many enemies, to feel the breath of Fidel Castro against the back of his neck. Today, Beatriz and Isabel are fighting off boredom by fighting with each other in the living room, while I sit on the couch, curled up with a book. God knows where Maria is, probably off chasing lizards in the backyard. She's crazy, isn't she? Beatriz's voice intrudes on my novel. What? I ask. Isabel! She's crazy for saying she'll marry Alberto. Tell her! Our eldest sister shoots daggers at Beatriz, her gaze turning swiftly to me. Our parents don't know about the engagement yet. Personally, I doubt Alberto had the stomach to face our father. Not that I can entirely blame him. Alberto's father is a doctor, successful and staunchly middle class, but not exactly sugar baron money. Alberto works as an accountant. He and Isabel met in Varadero 9 months ago, and from that moment she hasn't paid attention to any other man. He's handsome enough, and he does seem to genuinely care about Isabel, but I'm not quite sure how she feels about him. She's the most difficult one to read of all of us. She keeps her emotions locked tightly away, whereas Beatriz lets them fly for the entire world to see. I'd like to think I'm as contained as Isabel, but I fear my heart gives me away. If she's happy, that's all that matters, I reply. Isabel's expression softens, shooting me a grateful look. Beatriz lets out an inelegant snort. If only it were that simple! How long do you think happiness and love will continue once the difference in their circumstances is too much for them to overcome? Do you think it simply won't matter that she was born into all of this and he wasn't? Her tone gentles as her attention turns to Isabel. You love him, maybe. You're infatuated with him, yes? But is that enough for marriage? What else is there? Isabel snaps. Compatibility! Beatriz has an uncanny way of striking at the uncomfortable heart of things. We're fine in that department, but thanks for your concern, Isabel retorts. Beatriz rolls her eyes. I wasn't talking about sex. Beatriz, Isabel hisses, her face reddening. Please, like we don't know that's what you mean. Perhaps some of us don't believe you must say every single thing you think, that some things are private. Beatriz shrugs. I suppose I don't see the point in pretending. You haven't any sense. Sense? I'm not the one marrying a man who's utterly wrong for me. Beatriz rises from her perch on the sofa, her voice softening a bit. I love you. I don't want to see you make a mistake. Alberto is a nice enough man for someone. I just don't believe he's right for you. And I want you to be with a man who is worthy of you. A man who is your match in every way. Then you presume too much. We are not all you. We do not all have your ambitions. Alberto makes me happy. He is a good man. That is enough. Isabel's gaze narrows. Is that why you reject every man who proposes? Why you play the flirt and keep them at arm's length? Because you don't think they're worthy of you? Beatriz shrugs, flashing us an enigmatic smile. If telling yourself that makes you feel smug and superior about your own choices, then sure. She leaves us without a goodbye. She is impossible, Isabel mutters. She can be. She also can be too perceptive by half. A minute later, Isabel leaves the room and I am alone with my thoughts. Not an entirely welcome place to be. It's been a week since I've heard from Pablo, since I received that last letter. A week of uncertainty and nerves. A week of missing him terribly. Has he simply tired of me? Or is there something more at play? Has danger befallen him? I can't help but think of Beatrice's words to Isabel now. Is she correct? Once passion fades, are we left with compatibility? And if so, will Pablo and I forever be at odds, viewing the world from distinct and opposing beliefs? One of the gardeners walks into the room, his hat in his hands, a look of discomfort on his face. He's one of the staff members I've been bribing for weeks now, using them to carry letters back and forth between Pablo's messengers and me. I'm fairly certain Beatriz does the same thing with our brother. Miss Elisa, there's a man to see you. He's in the backyard. I leap off the couch, mustering what little decorum I can in the face of overwhelming relief and excitement. He's home. In the end, I can't resist the impulse to follow Pablo through the city to the house where he's been staying. The residence is in the Vedado district, a few streets from Guillermo's home, the site of our first meeting. It's a nondescript place filled with generic furnishings, sparse decor, and a faintly stale scent that suggests it hasn't been aired out in a long time. "Are you the only one staying here?" I ask when he closes the door behind us.
"For now. I live here from time to time."
The floor plan is fairly open, room leading into room, and I follow Pablo as he walks into the kitchen, my gaze running over his appearance. He looks leaner, and at the same time more muscular than when I last saw him, as though he's been shaped and molded, chiseled down to the bare essentials during his time in the mountains. His skin is darker than it was when he left, his hair a touch longer than is fashionable. His face is once again freshly shaved. Wearing a scraggly beard in Havana these days is tantamount to testing the limits of Batista's self-restraint. I can't stop looking at him, wanting to pinch myself. This isn't a dream. He's been gone for a month. I've missed him for a month. And now we're here, and we're alone.
"Can I get you a drink? Or something to eat? I have a few things in the cupboards."
He grins.
"I warn you, I'm not the most domestic."
I shake my head.
"Do you want to sit?"
He walks out of the narrow kitchen and gestures toward a faded couch shoved into a corner of the tiny room. To the left of me, Pablo stands in the doorway to the kitchen. To the right of me is another doorway. I can make out the edge of a mattress covered in a navy blue spread, a pair of trouser pants draped across the foot of the bed. This intimate view of his domestic life sending a flutter to my stomach. I could rationalize my decision by saying there's an uncertainty thickening the air in Havana these days, that each shot, each explosion, each act of rebellion pushes us closer and closer to the edge, and I don't know what we'll find when we get there. I could point to my own lack of control in my life, the match that was lit months ago burning strong and bright inside me. I could use so many excuses to justify love, but in the end, none of them seem to matter much anymore. He is here. I love him. There is nothing else. I leave Pablo standing in the doorway to the kitchen, my heart pounding as I walk toward the bedroom. My knees tremble beneath my dress. His gaze heats my skin. Perhaps this is foolish. It most likely is. But what is there in life if not the ability to indulge in the occasional foolish moment? How many of these indulgences do I have left? I stop a foot away from the bed, its outline mottled by the dying daylight. I take a deep breath, then another, my back to him, my fingers shaking as I pull my hair forward, draping it over my shoulder, fumbling with the buttons at my nape. The sound of his feet against the carpet, each inhale and exhale of breath, fills the room. Pablo stops. I already gave him my heart, but I can't deny that there's something equally momentous in this, too, or that I'm more than a little nervous. His lips ghost across my nape, followed by his fingers at the back of my dress, his knuckles brushing my spine. A reenactment of that first night in the yard behind Guillermo's house. Pablo undoes the line of buttons, the air hitting my back with each one. When he's finished, he kisses my skin, turning me in his arms.
"Are you sure?"
Pablo asks, his voice taut. "Yes." He leans into me, and I wrap my arms around his shoulders, stroking between the blades, reveling in the feel of him, the scent of him. He rests his forehead against mine, his eyes closed.
"I love you,"
he whispers. My eyes slam closed. It's silly, really, that saying the words out loud gives them so much power. But it does. I love you too. We lie in bed beside each other, the sheets pooled around our waists. The act of being naked in front of a man, even Pablo, is too novel for me to be entirely comfortable. So I rest on my stomach, my head propped on the pillow, watching him. His hand trails down my back, his fingers walking the length of my spine, the sensation both soothing and ticklish. I bury my head in the pillow, stifling another laugh. I give up. I can't take it anymore. Pablo grins, wrapping his arms around me and pulling me snug against his body, burying his face in my hair.
Have I told you how much I love you?
He asks. I turn to face him. How much? A note of seriousness threads through my teasing tone. There are so many differences between us, and I know why I admire him. His passion, honor, and conviction. What does he admire in me?
With everything I have, everything I am,
he answers.
You're the hope in all of this. I've been fighting for so long now that I almost forget what life was like before. Who I was when I was just a lawyer in Havana. A brother, a son, a friend. When I'm with you, I remember the man I used to be. The man who had hope. A man who wasn't surrounded by death. I want to be the kind of man who deserves you. A good man. An honorable man. A man devoted to his country and his family. You are my family now, Elisa. You're smart, and you're kind, and you're loyal. You have faith and courage, and you push me to be better, to believe in those things too. I want to be a man you're proud of, a man you could love. I want the same things. To be someone he admires, to fight for what I believe in just as he does. He makes me want to be brave. I love you, I whisper. Always. Pablo takes my hand, his lips running over my naked ring finger. I wish you could wear my ring on your hand for everyone to see, he says against my skin. My heart thunders at the promise contained there. Me too. The keeping of this secret becomes progressively more difficult, a little more painful. And with each day he fights against Batista, protecting him becomes even more important. Pablo's fingers move to my brow, stroking there, tracing the line, sweeping down to caress my face. You're worried, he says.
There's hardly a point in lying to him. I am. What happens next? Is this it?
This will never be it.
What else can there be? I ask. My tone bleak.
Us growing old together. Raising a family together. Watching our children have children of their own. Falling asleep beside each other at night, and waking next to each other every morning.
Do you really think we can have that?
I hope so. If not, what are we fighting for?
How bad is it in the mountains? We hear things, but it's impossible to know what's real and what's false with Batista. They say he's censoring more and more.
That's because we're advancing. We captured one of Batista's garrisons. At some point, morale will play a factor. His military is fighting their own countrymen, have been doing so for years now. And most of them know Batista's not worth dying for. We'll wear them down. And if we don't, another group will. He has too many enemies to survive this.
How bad is it?
I repeat. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want it touching you. I get through the nights in the mountains by imagining you here, safe in the city. Imagining our future together. Pablo grimaces. War is never anything other than bad. And anyone who tells you otherwise is a liar.
I worry about you, I confess. All the time. Wonder where you are. What you're doing, if you're alive. It's so strange to go about my day as though everything is normal. To not be able to tell anyone about you. While I feel like half my heart has been torn from my chest, I take a deep breath. I worry something will happen to you and I won't know, considering we're little more than secrets in each other's lives. My brother is a conduit of sorts between us, my ears within Cuba's rebellion. But his whereabouts are equally difficult to predict.
Pablo squeezes my hand. If anything happens to me while I'm gone, Guillermo will find you. It won't come to that, though, because I'm coming home to you, Elisa. Batista himself couldn't keep me away.
Where will you go?
Che is marching towards Santa Clara. He and his men plan to make a stand against Batista's forces.
And you will join them?
Yes.
Are you ever afraid? I can't imagine the risks he takes, the dangers he faces.
I was with Latour in the Sierra Maestra at the end of July.
He pushes up on his elbow, the sheet falling to his waist, my gaze dropping to his lean chest before returning to his eyes.
We fought the Cuban army. Men died beside me, their bodies crumpling to the ground as their blood spilled over the mountains. Latour was killed. Fidel came to bolster our forces, but we were already surrounded by Batista's army. Fidel had to negotiate a ceasefire. Try to, at least, in order to give us a chance to escape. We were a breath away from being wiped out. The revolution, everything we fought for, over. I was afraid then.
Would that be such a bad thing? If the ceasefire had held? We've been fighting for what, over 5 years? What has the rebellion accomplished other than chipping away at us? Batista's still in power.
He won't be forever. What else is there to do but fight? There is nothing I wouldn't do for Cuba. Nothing I wouldn't sacrifice.
Pablo climbs out of bed, walking to where his clothes lie in a pile on the floor, where I stripped them from his body, a sliver of light from the open window highlighting his nakedness. My body is suddenly cold without his warmth. I never considered that the war would make monsters out of all of them, but I fear it now. There's a danger in the way we live, in blithely continuing on as though nothing is wrong with the society we've created. But there's also danger in the fervor that fills him, the emotion driving all of the bearded ones. And suddenly I am very afraid.
I love you, Pablo says, his voice fierce.
I close my eyes.
I love you, too.
I've never told a man I wasn't related to that I loved him before today. Never had a man say those words to me. It should feel like the beginning of everything, but it sounds unmistakably like goodbye. Pablo reaches into his trouser pocket, pulling out a tiny box. I still. He flips open the box. His voice is hoarse.
It was my grandmother's.
The ring is beautiful and delicate, the diamonds arranged in a vintage shape. I swallow, my mouth going dry at the sight of that ring, my heart thundering in my chest. It's fast, much too fast. He's leaving. Revolution is here, knocking on the door. Pablo swallows, a tremor in his voice.
I don't know what kind of life we'll have when this is over. I probably won't be able to give you the life you're used to. But I love you. Always. I can promise you that.
Tears slide down my face. He slides the ring on my finger. Come back to me, I say.
I promise.
Chapter 17. Marisol. I check us into a resort on the beach, Luis beside me as I speak to the woman behind the desk, curiosity in her gaze. We lack the familiarity of longtime couples, and it's impossible to miss the tension between us. Luis shifts from side to side, his hands sunk deep in the pockets of his trousers, his eyes trained to a spot on the wall, near but not quite meeting the receptionist's gaze. I glance around us. We're surrounded by couples, families, all clearly tourists. A man stands off to the side, a folded copy of Grandma in his hand. While obviously a local, he definitely doesn't look like a guest. In the research I did before coming to Cuba, I read about the more tragic parts of life here. The flourishing sex trade, tourists preying on the sheer desperation of Cuban men and women who can earn more in a night selling themselves than they will in a year working for the state. Does she think that's what this is?
that my expensive clothes and bags, fat wad of CUCs in my hand, mean I'm here taking advantage of Luis? I finished the transaction quickly, my gaze now resting on the same invisible point that draws Luis's attention, my heart pounding. We are in an unlikely match, and I have no clue how to bridge the differences between us. I know a thing or two about Cuban pride. Is he ashamed that I'm the one paying for the room? That the differences between us are so vast? Will his friends judge him for taking up with a rich American, view him as a sellout, or me as his winning lottery ticket? And how could I explain this to my family? Would they consider Luis a communist because he stayed behind, because his family has served the regime in different capacities? I can't imagine him in my world, and I certainly don't belong in his. Where does that leave us? Luis carries my bag and his own, following my lead as we walk through the lobby, heading toward the room the woman assigned us. We step into the elevator, blissfully empty, and I stare down at my feet, doubts running through my mind. I should have gotten us two rooms. This has bad idea written all over it. We barely know each other. I came here to lay my grandmother to rest, not to have a fling, however much I gravitate toward him. This is happening too quickly, gaining speed with each moment we spend together, with each kiss. Marisol. Luis takes my hand, his fingers stroking my wrist. For most of my life, it was against the law for Cubans to stay in hotels like this. Now we can, but only the smallest percentage of Cubans can actually afford them. I'm sorry if I'm a bit. He pauses as though he's searching for the right word. Uncomfortable, he finishes. It's not you. It's simply the way of things. I can't imagine the lack of freedom he describes, not to mention the feeling that Cubans are treated as though their country isn't even theirs, as though their wants, their needs, their lives are subservient to the foreigners who come and go at will, when they themselves have little to no control over their own movements. I've never done this before, he adds. No American tourists? I ask, my heart thundering in my chest as I struggle to keep my tone light. No tourists at all. He leans into me, his lips brushing my cheekbone. This means something to me. This means something to me, too, I reply. The elevator pings and the door slides open. Luis holds his arm out while I walk into the hall, following the sign to our room. There it is, 610. I fumble with the key, my fingers shaking as I try to turn it in the lock. Once, twice. The key scrapes against the metal, my palms damp. Luis steps up, his chest against my back, his hand covering mine. He takes the key from me, slipping it into the lock, turning it in one fluid motion. Goosebumps rise over my skin. His free arm snakes around my waist, holding me against him, his breath on my neck, his face buried in my hair. The door opens, revealing our hotel room. It's small, but clean. Certainly not opulent, but enough. We cross the threshold, Luis's arm still around me, and the door closes behind us with a click. We're finally alone. I set my bag on the floor near the door, my gaze on the bed. It overshadows everything else in the room. The implication contained there setting off a whole new set of jitters. Is this really about to happen? I take a deep breath, then another, attempting to sift through the emotions tumbling around inside me. A part of me wants this desperately, has wanted it from the beginning. The desire intensified by our kisses on the beach, by each moment I spend with him. The other part of me is still mulling over the impossibility of us, guarding my heart as I listen to my head. A little caution seems prudent in this situation, even as my willpower crumbles with each second that passes. What are we doing here? I ask, staring at the bed, the floral bedspread, the two pillows propped against the headboard. I imagine us lying there, limbs entwined. I don't know. Luis admits as he takes a step closer to me, then another. You are entirely unexpected. Is that a bad thing?
No. Just complicated. He takes a deep breath.
I thought you were beautiful when I watched you walk out of the airport. You looked so vibrant and excited, your hair blowing in the breeze. I hoped you were the one I was there to pick up. And then you walked toward me, and I thanked whatever power it was that brought us together.
I turn, facing him, the uncertainty in his expression surprisingly reassuring, the desire in his eyes sending a thrill through me.
I thought you were laughing at me,
I confess.
I thought you were charming, he says. And yes, you made me laugh, but not at you.
And then I drove you through Havana, took you to your family's house and saw the way you looked at it, heard the way you spoke of your family, of what being Cuban meant to you. And I knew.
Knew what?
That you were here for me.
How? How can this work?
I don't know what I want here, I say, my voice barely above a whisper, the caution and control I clung to slipping away.
In this moment, I want you. But after that,
then maybe we just have this moment.
Is that enough?
He smiles, a tinge of sadness on his face. I have a feeling there will never be enough moments with you, Marisol.
If any other guy said that to me, I would dismiss it as another line, a move in the dating game. But there is something eminently trustworthy in him, and the sincerity I saw in him from the beginning, the solemnity in his expression, the truth in his words removes any doubt. He is not a careless man, and whatever the future holds, I know he will be careful with me. My legs quiver as I sink down on the edge of the bed. My fingers fist the bedspread beneath me as I stare at the bright pattern, the garish colors blending together into a kaleidoscope before my eyes, my heart thundering in my chest. How can someone be so comforting and yet utterly terrifying at the same time? When I look up, Luis is standing next to the edge of the bed, the leg of his trousers brushing against my knees. He doesn't speak, but he doesn't have to. There have been moments when I've found him to be impossible to read, but in this moment, in this hotel room, his guard is down, his emotions etched all over his face, in the tremor in his hand as he reaches out and strokes my hair, as I curl into his touch, as he skims the curve of my cheek. My eyes slam closed. I wait for him to kiss me, to lever me back onto the mattress, his strong arms wrapping around my waist, pulling me against his sinewy frame. I wait for a moment that stretches on and on until I can't wait anymore, the anticipation building inside me, the spark that was lit burning fierce and strong. In the end, I'm the one who moves, because while I don't have the answers to any of the questions filling me with doubt and uncertainty, I know this. If I don't close the distance between us now, I will regret it for the rest of my life. I lean into the arc of his body, pulling him down to meet me, catching him on an exhale, my mouth pressed against his breath becoming my breath, my hands taking over, my body colliding with his as the last of my misgivings retreat. Luis bends me back, taking over the kiss, lowering me to the mattress, the comforter rough against the bare skin above my dress, his body firm against mine, a hint of breeze blowing across my skin from the ceiling fan rotating overhead, the distant noise of guests in the hall intruding on our privacy. He whispers endearments to me in the language of my heart, his lips ghosting across my earlobe, his hands roaming over my curves, his fingers unhooking and removing clothing in a tangle of limbs, as I fumble with the buttons of his shirt, his belt, our shoes falling off the edge of the bed, our movements punctuated by the occasional bout of laughter, by a sweeping wave of desire that binds me to him with each moment that passes, until the rightness of this, of us, simply eclipses all else. Afterward, we lie in bed, naked, my head resting on his bare chest, his hand stroking my hair. Minutes pass. The only sound in the room is the inhale and exhale of breath. What comes next? His fingers walk across my skin. I tip my head toward him for a kiss.
I wasn't expecting this when I picked you up at the airport.
Luis whispers against my mouth. I wasn't expecting any of this, I admit. I came here planning to write an article about traveling to Cuba, and instead of paladares and sightseeing, my notepad is filled with politics.
Cuba is rubbing off on you, he says,
pride in his voice. I guess it is.
You could write an article about politics once you're home, you know.
Cuban politics?
Why not?
Politics aren't really my thing. I write about accessible topics. The best restaurants to eat at when you're in a particular city. A skincare regimen that will help keep wrinkles at bay. The ideal way to pack your suitcase to maximize your storage space.
And politics aren't accessible?
I turn onto my side, facing him. I suppose I've never seen myself that way. I'll leave things like revolutions to people who are well-versed in what they're talking about. I'm not exactly known for being serious. I offer a wry grin. I'm sort of the flighty one in the family. Luis makes a disapproving noise in his throat.
You can write about revolutions and the best way to pack your suitcase. One doesn't make you less than the other.
I laugh. If only it were that simple.
Why isn't it?
Because my family expects things of me. Because my last name carries a weight of responsibility and I've never quite measured up. I doubt anyone cares to hear what I have to say about politics. Every family has that one person who doesn't fit. That's always been me.
Except for my grandmother.
She adjusted to the curves and shifts of my life with agility and understanding, and occasionally a plate of merenguitas.
It can be simpler than you think,
Luis replies.
You can't live your life to please others if you're not proud of yourself. I saw the man Cristina wanted me to be, and no matter how hard I tried to pretend, I simply could not be that sort of man. The type who turned a blind eye to injustice and cruelty and still retained some semblance of pride.
Are you happy now? He smiles.
Am I happy in this very moment? Right now, in bed with you?
I grin, burying my head in the curve of his neck. Yes.
Yes,
he echoes. I look into his eyes, my fingers skimming the bruise on his cheekbone, his expression sobering. I open my mouth to speak. I don't know.
Things are complicated right now, he says, finishing the thought for me.
Yes.
I'm leaving in a few days, and he'll remain here.
Even as things are slowly, subtly changing, a wall exists between our countries, an ocean of differences, and I don't know how to navigate it. Luis sighs, his chest heaving with the effort.
These are difficult times in Cuba. Right now my fortunes are hers, and unless things radically change, they're on a decidedly downward trend.
He's silent for a heartbeat.
I don't want them to be yours.
Is it better for anyone than it was before?
Is the status quo better for some? Perhaps.
Luis answers after a beat.
For those involved in the upper echelons of the regime, sure. The military, for one. I saw that firsthand. For certain members of the artistic class, their art shields them from that which most Cubans experience. They can travel.
Tout their talent and the impression that it was nurtured in a Cuba that prizes education and art, making Cuba look good. Same for the baseball players and other elite athletes.
And for those who don't agree with the regime?
Luis grimaces.
Then it is very bad.
He sits up, pulling away from me, leaning back against the headboard. Gone is the man content to languish over my curves, interspersing his caresses with laughing kisses.
It's a bit better for the farmers, I suppose, for those living in the rural areas,
Luis continues.
They were pushed to the fringes of Cuban society under Batista. Under Fidel, they at least had the ability to feed themselves off the land, even if they risked imprisonment to do it. When we were hungry, life in the city became a curse.
When I was a boy, we went to the country, and a family friend gave us meat from one of his animals that he had killed. It was illegal for us to have it, but food was scarce then, and we were so hungry. On the way back to Havana, our car broke down, the same one I am driving now. And I will never forget the fear in my grandmother's and mother's eyes as men came and helped us get it working again, as they worried someone would discover the meat in their trunk. What would have happened? Life in prison. I gasp. Luis shrugs. When you're so hungry you fear you will die, you're willing to risk it. It wasn't always like that in Cuba, but there were too many times when desperation was all we knew. Her mother and grandmother must have been very strong to survive on their own like that, to raise you amid such tumult. Luis smiles, love shining in his eyes. They're amazing. Two of the strongest people I've ever known. My grandmother is all smiles and welcomes everyone. My mother is more guarded, but she's always been there for me. Did your mother ever think of leaving Cuba with you? We never discussed it, Luis answers. When my father was alive, there was no need. Life was relatively good as an officer's wife, as an officer's son. And I think my mother was more open to the regime back then. Her family believed in Fidel's reforms. It was a passion she and my father initially shared. Although I imagine that passion has all but disappeared after she's seen the future the revolution promised. I can't believe the regime has lasted so long given the life you describe. It would be narrow-minded to say the entire country feels as I do. But many do, Luis replies. And even though we cannot wear that banner proudly, I believe there are enough of us to change things. He delivers the words with such conviction that I almost believe it possible. Did any of Fidel's reforms succeed? I ask. The social ones fared far better than the economical and political ones, for sure. Look, it's not all bad. I agree with some of the things he's done or attempted to do. Being black in Cuba is a bit better than it was in 1959, on paper at least, Luis adds. But is a bit better enough? It's been nearly 60 years. How much has the world changed in that time? Race still matters here, even though the regime says it does not. The majority of the exiles who send money back in the form of remittances to their relatives are of European descent. My black friends face difficulty getting hired to work in the tourism sector. Without remittances, without access to CUCs, the deck is stacked against black Cubans. And how can we measure racial inequality when the regime willfully ignores it? Men and women are equal under Fidel's government, but what does that mean? On paper tells a far different tale from the reality of everyday life. This incremental progress where we exalt Fidel for the fact that things have gotten just the tiniest bit better in nearly 60 years is not enough. Fidel was good for Fidel and his cronies. The rest of us deserve more. He makes a sound of disgust. This island will break your heart if you let it. I think of my grandmother dreaming of a country just removed from her grasp. 90 miles that stretched on to eternity. Of all the refugees and exiles in Miami and throughout the world. And I can't disagree with him. Would you ever want to travel to the United States? If things changed and opportunities for Cubans increased? The question fills the air around us. The divide between our circumstances, the elephant in the room. I don't know. I got my passport years ago when they finally made it legal to travel. It seemed safe to hedge my bets even if the cost was prohibitively expensive. Without the palavad, I never would have had the funds. In Cuba, your passport is issued for 6 years, but it costs about $200 to perform the mandatory renewal every 2 years. Nearly a year's salary every 2 years to just hold a passport. Add in the cost of travel, and it seems like a very distant dream unless you have an outside benefactor or access to CUCs. And the United States? Luis sighs. It's complicated. Within Cuba, there are different views on our relationship with the Americans. Some believe the United States is the source of our problems. Others dream of moving there so they can earn enough money to send back to their families and eventually bring them over, too. And some think the reality lies in the middle. Where do you fall on the United States? I ask. half afraid of his answer. Is it possible to separate your political views from your personal ones? To love someone who represents something you don't agree with? I am American. Does he see me as an extension of my country's, at times, flawed policies? We've paid the price of politics over and over again, Luis responds. The embargo is ridiculous. It hurt the Cuban people, not Fidel and his cohorts. It doesn't work.
True.
But to some it isn't merely politics. For the most part, there's a generational divide on the embargo. My grandparents' contemporaries hate the idea of giving Fidel anything after he took everything from them. They had family members that stood before those firing squads, whose blood spilled on the ground, who were imprisoned for speaking out against injustice. Families were torn apart. They were separated from their loved ones, their memories, their legacies. Everything they had was seized by the government when they left. Their thoughts, emotions, lives were regulated by Fidel before they left. They watched the country they loved change into something they no longer recognized. The anger among the exiles is legitimate. It's lessened with each subsequent generation, but there are real reasons for the anger. The revolution didn't happen nearly 60 years ago for them. They live the revolution over and over again. With each day they are in exile. With each hour they are reminded that they cannot go home.
And those of us who remained? Luis asks. In some cases, perhaps those Cubans were made to leave. But for the most part, you seem to forget that they had a choice.
Did they, though? How can you live in a place that seeks to eradicate your existence? That offers so little and takes so much?
I don't have the answer to that. But you've seen the people suffering here. What do you think of the embargo?
The embargo hurts the Cuban people and fails to target the regime, I reply. But I didn't lose a loved one to Fidel. My whole life, everything I worked for, wasn't taken from me. My generation is less inclined to hold on to the anger, but I am loyal to my grandmother, to my great aunts. For the exiles, being Cuban means you're born with a loathing for Fidel, even after his death. Luis smiles ruthlessly.
That might be another trait we share.
Where do you stand on all of this? I ask again.
I love my country, he replies. I am Cuban. I will always be Cuban. Go to America to visit, perhaps. But my home is here. My loyalty is with my country.
Is it really that simple, though? Not everyone has the luxury of trying their Cuban heritage to a place. For many, being Cuban is something they carry with them in their hearts, something they fight to preserve even when all they have are their memories. When they left, they couldn't take anything with them. No photographs, no official documents, no family heirlooms or mementos. That kind of exile makes you angry.
You're right. Both sides love Cuba. They just do it in different ways.
Some love it so much they can't leave. Others love it so much they cannot stay. Luis takes a deep breath.
I write, under a pseudonym, online.
The words would be innocuous anywhere else. I know quite a few people who blog on a wide range of subjects, but Luis doesn't say the words like they're innocuous. Rather, as if he's entrusting me with a secret, a deadly one. There's an earnestness there, too, as though he wants me to know him. And this is the most intimate part.
What do you write about?
I ask, even though I already know the answer.
Politics.
He's been hinting at it the entire time, and now that I know him better, it's not shocking, really. He has a strong sense of justice, coupled with an appreciation for history, and there is an abundance of injustice around him. The look in his eyes, the fury blazing above a fading bruise on his cheekbone, says it all.
What would they do if they found out?
I ask. That's the reason for the pseudonym, isn't it?
Yes. I wanted to protect my family. They didn't sign up for this, and it didn't seem fair that they would suffer for me speaking out.
What would they do? I ask again, a chill sliding down my spine as my gaze drifts back to the hints of violence on his face.
It depends on how big of a threat they determined me to be, and given that I'm a professor teaching at the university, where I possess the power to subvert my students, he sighs. They could see